The Defense Security Service reports foreign governments are increasing their espionage activities against U.S. computer systems. Every year, the Targeting U.S. Technologies Trend Analysis of Cleared and Industry Reporting highlights a specific technological sector that was targeted in attacks. Jeff Carr is the founder and CEO of Taiya Global and looking at the latest report. Jeff, thanks for coming on the program. It's great to talk to you this morning. What's the significance, do you think, that this year DSS looked at inertial navigation systems? Thanks for your time today.
Hey, Francis, it's always a pleasure, and thank you for having me on board. The DSS chose that particular sector after looking at the members of the defense industrial base that they communicate with. I think that's actually a sample sector. So it's simply something that the readers of the report can see a demonstration of a technology that's of interest to foreign governments. It could have been any sector, and if you go back every year, you'll see a different sector each year.
You write, you make a great point in the blog post that you have. We linked at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive that it's something I think gets lost a lot when we talk about cyber espionage. You point out cyber espionage is simply a new way to conduct industrial espionage. So it's reasonable to assume that governments and corporations who are attempting to acquire a specific technology will also use a network attack if it produces a successful end result. How should that make people think differently, do you think, about the ways that foreign governments might conduct cyber espionage against either a government contractor or a government agency, Jeff?
Well, so what the great thing about this report, this is actually one of the best reports that's been produced on the topic of industrial espionage, because it looks at the large threat landscape. It doesn't take a slice out of the pie and only looks at cyber attacks. It looks at every aspect of how a foreign government might acquire the kind of technology that they're interested in, and that includes even academic solicitations, which I thought was very interesting. Where you as a U.S. researcher, you're simply invited to speak at a scientific conference. Held by a major, world-renowned university, other ways might be being invited as a company, as an employee of a company, to open an office doing R&D in their host country. This has been very successful over the years for China. Going all the way back to 2000, they may have had, I believe, around 100 foreign R&D offices in China. 7 years after that, they had 1,200. I mean, that's an expansion, an incredible expansion, once they learned that U.S. companies are eager to take advantage of foreign R&D researchers. So by looking at the larger threat landscape, companies can become more aware of how many different ways there are for foreign government to acquire the type of intellectual property that they're spending billions a year in devising or inventing.
Jeff, I always appreciate when someone reads between the lines and helps me understand what's not there. You write about what the DSS report doesn't say. You write, it doesn't tell you who's doing the collecting. Why is it important to understand that?
Right. We favor raising attention to a specific nation, when in fact there are multiple nations engaged in this activity. So, because of privacy rules, countries can only really look at their network logs and collect information about attacks that are sourced within borders of other countries. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's that country that's literally doing the collecting. For example, the FBI recently announced an indictment against a Chinese businessman who utilized some independent hackers, also Chinese, but who never actually launched their attacks from inside China's borders. They were very careful to open up what they called machine offices in foreign countries, including the U.S., where those attacks would be launched from. And then when the information was delivered to China, it was hand-carried in using USB sticks, never actually an electronic form of communication. So there's an awful lot of ways to fool network monitors. One of the things that we do we look at the R&D budgets of different countries and what might be of interest to those foreign governments, and then we pass that information on to U.S. companies so that they have a better view of the threat landscape globally and not just focus on any one particular foreign actor.
And that I think is interesting to connect then back to what we talked about earlier about the concept of cyber espionage simply being a new way to conduct espionage. Because if we think about the spycraft history of the United States and the people who have been caught spying for other countries, in many cases, or in some cases, I should say, many might be an overstatement, but in some cases, those spies have represented our allies, people we considered to be our friends. And so it's fair to think, I imagine, that companies or countries, maybe even companies based in countries that we consider to be our friends and allies, might be engaged in the same kind of conduct, isn't it, Jeff?
Sure. In fact, I think it's one of the things that I like to encourage companies to do when we consult with them is try to identify what we call their target asset value. You know, what is their particular technology or intellectual property worth, not just to one government, but to multiple governments? You know, the more countries that are looking to innovate in an area that matches your technological development, the more governments that are interested in the sorts of things that your particular in-house team are working on inventing, the higher the target asset value is for your particular company. So that helps inform your decisions when you decide you're going to open your R&D labs in France or in Israel or in Brazil or in China or in Russia. It also helps inform where your executives travel when they travel overseas and what sort of security precautions you might want to take. That old saying, regarding the being able to tell the forest from the trees, that's why it's so important to have this sort of global awareness and not simply be stuck on any one particular type of threat actor.
Those are all great insights, Jeff. The part of it that I think is the most applicable to the people in my audience is the executive travel piece, because we have people both at very high levels of federal agencies and high levels of companies in the industrial base that sells to the government who are traveling overseas on an ongoing basis in all kinds of environments through all kinds of threat landscapes. And I wonder what the 1, 2, 3, 5 things are that you advise to companies and organizations with executives engaging in that kind of travel to protect themselves when they go overseas.
Yes. We do encourage certain practices be put into place. We try to make it, it's important that executives still be able to conduct business after all. And that is the number one thing. And so you can't be too onerous. But we do advise, for example, that executives carry a device, a mobile device, which is stripped down to only include the programs that are absolutely required for their use while they're overseas. We recommend that they not access a hotel Wi-Fi or an airport Wi-Fi, that they use their own hotspots on their own devices. We recommend that they carry encryption on their devices, including encrypting the files that they're working on, both at rest and in transit. So these are just some basic, steps that make it much more difficult for a foreign threat actor to obtain data that will be useful to them later on.
Jeff, it's always great to talk to you. I appreciate you coming on, and thanks very much for this insight today.
Oh, of course. Thanks for having me.